from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Good Friday afternoon to you. I am Sarah Perry, your host on this, the 12th of June, 2020. Thanks for joining us on today's edition of Washington Watch. The multi-block radius in Seattle that's been taken over by protesters and an Antifa mob, now being called the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, is holding fast. Experts are both urging the city to take back the area and warning at the same time that the tactics could be used in other cities to establish lawless autonomous zones. Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best said it was not her decision to leave the now abandoned East Police Precinct in the first place, but that she gave in to, quote, severe public pressure. Now, police in Miami have warned non-essential businesses to close early today in advance of protests after a police car was damaged and multiple officers were assaulted by rioters. Do these autonomous zones rise to the level of an insurrection? Well, I've got Ken Blackwell, FRC's Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, with his thoughts on where a White House investigation might reveal. In my second block, President Trump visited Dallas yesterday to participate in a roundtable with faith leaders, law enforcement officials, and small business owners to discuss solutions to historic economic health and justice disparities in American communities. I'll have Ashley Bell, entrepreneurship policy advisor for the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council, to discuss the president's commitment to helping underserved communities thrive. At the bottom of the hour, Austin Roos, president of the Center for Family and Human Rights and author of the forthcoming Catholic Case for Trump, will join me to discuss the president's international leadership on life and religious liberty. And in my last block, David Harsanyi, senior writer at the National Review, sees America as a nation on the precipice of a high-tech, bloodless cultural revolution, one that relies on intimidation, public shaming, and economic ruin to dictate what words and ideas are permissible in the public square. The illiberal liberals would have us believe that words are violence. So are the notions of free speech and open debate in America dead? We'll discuss. As a reminder, our website for today's podcast is TonyPerkins.com. You can also follow us on social media. Go to our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at FRCDC, me at Sarah P. Perry, or Tony at T. Perkins. Also a reminder, and you know what's coming, if you don't have the Stand Firm app, make sure that you download it in your Apple or Google Play stores right now. If you don't have the updated version, make sure you do that too. That way you can take Washington Watch with you wherever you go. Well, after weeks of protest in response to the death of George Floyd, protesters and activists in Seattle have taken control of an area they are deeming the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. While armed guards stand at the entry and exit points and shake down local businesses for money, Democratic Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin had this to say about the Capitol Hill encampment.
Lawfully gathering and expressing First Amendment rights, demanding we do better as a society, and providing true equity for communities of color is not terrorism. It is patriotism.
Well, it would seem that Durkin and Seattle Police Department Assistant Police Chief Deanna Nolet have differences of opinion on the matter, though. Nolet had this to say.
We have been hearing from community members that they have been subjected to barricades set up by the protesters, with some armed individuals running them as checkpoints while Washington is an open carry state. There is no legal right for those arms to be used to intimidate community members. If someone feels threatened or intimidated, we ask that they call 911 and report the incident. We have heard anecdotally reports of citizens and businesses being asked to pay a fee to operate within this area. This is the crime of extortion.
Well, the White House has now opened an investigation into whether Seattle's police-free autonomous zone constitutes an insurrection, and if so, what might be done about it. Joining me now to talk about this is FRC Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, Ken Blackwell. Ken, always love talking to you.
Sarah, it's good to be with you. It's a very, very important time for us to have a a discussion about the Constitution and the responsibility of those institutions that govern us. And let's just start out by saying that the purpose of government is spelled out in the Constitution to secure unalienable rights, including those of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the manifestation of this purpose is at the most basic level, and that is local government, that unit of government that's closest to the people, that responsibility to protect life and safety and the property of citizens, you know, is paramount. And the police and safety forces are the components of government that serve that function on a daily basis. And in Seattle, we see them on retreat.
Yes.
They are retreating at the at the command of the mayor. And Sarah, let me just say, you know, there was this old comedic line of Flip Wilson. You know, he said, you know, don't believe your lying eyes. You know, Americans can see what is going on, and they're being told by this mayor who has her head stuck in the sand not to believe their lying eyes. And her citizens are at risk, and her city is occupied.
I tell you what bothers me about this, multiple things, but the fact that Durkin herself is complicit in this. She refuses to acknowledge the fact that there are armed guards that are extorting individuals for money. The assistant police chief, you heard her quote. We're also learning that Seattle Councilwoman Kashma Sawant, who is an open socialist, she identifies as such. She and her staff let hundreds of protesters inside City Hall on Tuesday night, which PS is supposed to be locked after business hours, screaming that her fellow council members were sellouts and calling for the Democratic mayor to resign, i.e. the same Democratic mayor that we just recently heard from saying that these are just simply peaceable protests and nothing more. So not only are the police on retreat, we have the rest of government complicit in basically ceding control of this area to the mob. Do you believe that the majority of Americans want less police officers, less law enforcement, less money for police departments? Where are the stats on this?
Look, I don't believe that Americans want to turn over their cities to disruptors and domestic terrorists. Unfortunately, there are those who would like nothing more than to politicize, you know, a rare abuse of power like we witnessed in Minneapolis, to sow division, to undermine and destabilize the United States, and to use the coordinated chaos they create to force their agenda, their socialist agenda, their lawless agenda on the American public. Look, the Constitution and congressional acts give the president the legal power to call up the National Guard unit and even active duty forces to stop disturbances that prevent the law enforcement the enforcement of the law. And right now, what we have in a situation where the president is speaking into the situation, saying he understands his responsibility, he's on ready, and you know, and I would hope that the governor and the mayor finally come to their senses and do the right thing. But the people have to know that leadership in Washington, the president of the United States, you know, while he's refrained from any widespread deployment of troops, he is on the ready to make sure that peace is restored so justice can be pursued in any situation and meaningful reforms can take place.
You know, we know, based on, and you've referenced without the specific name, the Insurrection Act. So this is obviously up for consideration right now. This is a law that dates to 1807. This is the codification of Article 1, Section 8 of congressional authority to provide for calling forth the militia if needed when there are requirements to suppress insurrections, to repel invasions. Well, I tell you what, if this doesn't rise to the level of an insurrection, particularly when you have local law enforcement that has essentially thrown up its hands and said, well, we're not going to get involved. Sorry about this. We're just going to cede authority to this area, to the protesters themselves. In fact, we have learned that the mayor has provided portable toilets for this area. So at this point, she is aiding and abetting this illegal takeover of these 6 to 8 blocks of Capitol Hill area in Seattle. So to your mind, is this one of those extraordinary circumstances in which the president ought to say, listen, I hate to invoke it, but I've given you enough time to quell this rebellion, and I don't know how else to refer to it, because that is, to my mind, what this is ultimately tantamount to. I've given you enough time. It's time now for me to act.
This sort of behavior is contagious, and the president has, with restraint, because he and his attorneys are clear of what the triggers are for initiating the Insurrection Act proceedings, and what he has basically said, not just to the mayors and the governors, he said to the people, the citizens who want safe neighborhoods, he said, I stand ready to do what's necessary to first back up your mayor and your governor, but if they fail to act, if they retreat, I am ready to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you think this does for the GOP's chances in November? We've seen a year in chaos. So we've had 6 untenable months, what we never thought we would see. We have seen this year the pandemic, the response in early hurricane season. We've seen the George Floyd riots. We've seen Antifa run amok. In this year, we have seen so much chaos. What do you think that forebears for the GOP's election chances in November?
I think this is going to be a base turnout election. And so folks who believe in the Constitution, believe in America and its strengths, understand that we're not a perfect nation, but we're a perfectible nation, and that in 242 years we have been that shining city on the hill because we have gotten better. And so those who want to define us as a racist nation versus those, in fact, want to define us as an opportunity society that works on getting better and better as we go by, as we go year after year, this is going to be a contest.
Yes.
This is going to be not pastel colors. This is going to be bold colors in terms of the choices that the American voters will have. We can't sit on the sidelines.
I cannot believe that the American people want their law enforcement officers to dissipate, to be defunded, to be dismantled, to be disbanded. The National Sheriff's Association has statistics telling us that 53% of Americans want increased funding for law enforcement. Rasmussen, 59% of Americans favor or are against reducing police budgets. They would much rather the money stay where it is. 55% of Democrats, however, support the move to defund police. So, Ken, when you say that everyone has to get out and vote, we truly mean everyone has to get out and vote. Ken Blackwell has been my guest in this segment. Coming up, we'll talk about President Trump's recent roundtable on race, reconciliation, and opportunity in Dallas with entrepreneurship policy advisor for the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council, Ashley Bell, right after this on Washington Watch.
As coronavirus restrictions begin to ease, many Americans are grappling with how to adapt to the changing times. The last few months have transformed how worshipers think about church and how they are fed spiritually. While many churches are conducting services through live streams, drive-in services, and other means, questions still remain. What practical steps can we take? Are current restrictions appropriate? Do these restrictions violate the Constitution or religious freedom protections? Family Research Council has a new publication discussing religious liberty issues and offering practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate as our country opens back up. Visit frc.org/churchguidelines to view this resource and learn more. As always, visit frc.org/church for our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. In his continued journey for racial reconciliation and increased opportunity for all Americans, President Trump visited Dallas yesterday to participate in a roundtable with faith leaders, law enforcement officials, and small business owners to discuss solutions to historic economic, health, and justice disparities in all American communities. Joining me now to talk about the roundtable and some of the administration's efforts to revitalize underserved communities is Ashley Bell, Entrepreneurship Policy Advisor for the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council and Regional Administrator for the Small Business Administration. Ashley, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me back. Good to be with you.
So talk to me a little bit about the purpose of this roundtable and what the president is hoping to accomplish through an event like this.
Well, I think the roundtable was a very important step forward for reconciliation for our country. The president understands that right now that Americans are desperately looking for solutions, and the president wants mm-hmm. to continue his excellent track record of offering solutions. So this roundtable was, you know, an opportunity for everybody to say, look, you know, let's talk about some of the issues that have plagued our country for decades, that this president inherited them. And how to look at ways that we can solve them. And so I think that having that roundtable talking about these issues when it comes to underserved communities and how a lack of education opportunities, a lack of economic opportunities, and the president was able to say, look, you know, here's where we are as an administration. We've addressed these issues in ways that nobody else has, and we've done so in a bipartisan fashion on many of the pieces of legislation. So let's continue this conversation, but let's also try to say, look, if we need to do reform around policing, let's understand it's a local mm-hmm. issue, but let's figure out what we can do nationally to coordinate together to do better together.
This is a great question because the minority communities are really hurting right now. And I had a chance earlier this week to be able to talk to one of the pastors who's an evangelical advisor to the president. And he said, you know, it would really help us as the Black community to hear the heart, to hear that you all understand that we're hurting, that these are longstanding wounds of ours. And I appreciate the president's heart on this to really reach these underserved communities. Do you think there's any breakdown in rhetoric when the president says, listen, we might even have to spend more on law enforcement? Do you think that's a message that's going to resonate with the minority communities?
You know, I think that when, you know, if you look at what's been happening and you look at some of the protests that once peaceful, you know, turned, you know, violent, and you see the small business owners of small African-American businesses that are struggling already because of we've asked them to close down because of COVID, and then they're now facing these just tough situations of having stability in their economy and their neighborhoods. And the president is echoing a strong message of look, we need to have order so people can chase their dreams, they can offer goods and services to the American people. Everybody understands that we are facing a crisis in this country when it comes to confidence right now in our systems, but we can't gain that confidence through more chaos. And so the president has been clear about that. I think you saw in a Rasmussen poll last week, the president has hit an all-time high of 40% approval rating, 72% also when it comes to his handling of the COVID crisis. These are numbers that no Republican has seen when it comes to African-American vote, the African-American community. So I think that the key here is that you can't just listen to mainstream media. You have to look exactly. Their lives are being affected, and they know this president is consistent and clear. And people are betting on someone who would rather be consistent and clear in their messaging and talk about solutions that revolve around policy rather than pandering. And I think that's been the hallmark of this president and will continue to be.
Oh, I love that. Policy rather than pandering. Talk to me specifically about some reforms in the justice system, because we know that there is a disproportionate number of African-American males that are incarcerated in the United States. What is he doing for justice reform?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I think the president has led on that in a way that no president has. This president, when it came to addressing the issues that systemically face African-Americans, and I specifically deal in this world as African-American males, as a public defender, attorney that's represented people that were poor in communities like where I grew up. The system it was unfair when it came to sentencing guidelines. The system had allowed a lot of folks who should be going home for nonviolent offenses to not be able to go home. And so the president was able to reach across the aisle, led by the leadership of Jared Kushner and the team at the White House, to reach across the aisle and pass the First Step Act. And here's the reality. The president understands that there's systematic issues with our criminal justice system, because the first 3,000 people that were let out of jail because of his First Step Act, 90% of them were African Americans. 90.
Oh wow.
So this is a reality that he knew. If I pass this legislation, I will give nonviolent criminals a chance to go home, to get a job, and to make sure they have the training necessary to get back to taking care of their families and being productive citizens. So when you have a piece of legislation like that, and 90% of the people that benefited from it are African American, that shows he clearly understands the disproportionate effect the system was having, and he's leveling the playing field and giving opportunity to people.
Oh, well said. Listen, I got about a minute and a half left here, but I do want to mention education, because the statement coming from the president's mouth about how the child's future shouldn't be determined by their zip code really resonated with me. We know a number of young African-American kids in the inner city whose education has been salvaged, literally salvaged, by a function of some very good charter schools and the operation of school choice principles. Talk a little bit about what he's doing in this regard.
Well, the president has been consistent in supporting school choice and opportunity for all students. I think this is a really big issue for African-American parents. You know, I have two children in public schools, and I can tell you that there is no more fundamental right of a parent than to be able to educate your child. And you want to make sure that you have an opportunity to educate your child in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. So what the president has been arguing is, look, there's no reason for you as a parent to have a failing school for your child and the government tell you that you're stuck, that there's no way out. That's what big government is doing. They're telling folks, look, we don't think you need to have a choice. You think your kids are stuck here. But you know what? Other folks across town that have different zip codes than you, that may look different than you, have options. We need to give everyone an option to succeed. If you really want to go to the core of the root of the civil unrest that we have in this country, if you leveled the playing field and gave every one of those children an opportunity to have a good education, you give every citizen an opportunity by the third grade to be able to know proficiently how to read, because after third grade, you don't learn to read, you read to learn. And once people can do that at the third grade and on, then you have a society where people know, look, I can take my future into my own hands. But what we're seeing right now, there are people who are fed up with the status quo. So it's not directed at this president. This president did not invent this unrest. But what this president will do is offer solutions to the unrest. The unrest comes from people who have ignored and has forgotten these communities for decades. He said when he became president, I will remember the forgotten communities and I will fight for them. And fighting for them means that you remember the fact that people who don't have an education don't have a way out of poverty. We can't break the cycle of poverty until we level the playing field. And giving parents a choice to save their children's education future is exactly what this president is focused on.
Coming up next on Washington Watch, how is the U.S. promoting life and religious liberty abroad? We will talk to CFAM President Austin Roos about it right after this.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. Thanks for tuning in with us. In a letter from USAID to the Secretary of the UN, the Trump administration requested the removal of abortion as an essential component of the UN's coronavirus plan. Shortly thereafter, President Trump signed his newest executive order, one that prioritizes international religious freedom and foreign policy and overseas government aid projects. Joining me now to discuss the president's record on life and religious liberty around the world is Austin Roos, president of the Center for Family and Human Rights, a UN human rights organization, and author of the forthcoming The Catholic Case for Trump. Austin, welcome.
I am so delighted to be with you today.
Well, I'm glad to have you. Listen, I'm really excited about an opportunity to talk about what he's done, not just domestically, but overseas. And as somebody who has written this forthcoming book, I'd love to get your perspective on this. First, on the pro-life issue, because the letter from USAID to the UN Secretary General was a really compelling one, and it did mark a stark contrast between what the UN prioritizes and what the United States prioritizes. So what really stood out to you in this effort?
Well, what you have to understand about Trump and the UN is he's doing things that no previous administration even thought about doing. I mean, put Clinton aside, put Obama aside. Of course, they were very bad on these issues, very aggressive. But President Bush never even thought about doing the things that President Trump is doing. Mm-hmm. It is astounding what he is doing. He has made certain terms controversial again, reproductive health, for instance. And this whole thing, the letter from USAID to the UN, had everything to do with abortion, but also reproductive health.
Yes.
So he has drawn a bright line saying, you know, we as a country will not accept certain things in UN documents. And quite honestly, President Bush never even thought about doing any of that stuff. So and most people don't know this because they don't follow the UN, you know, like we do.
Right.
You know, he's doing much more than any previous pro-life president.
So those terms, sexual and reproductive health, that appeared in this letter, they're referenced as being highly polarizing, as they are. And yet I think we are being fed the line, if you believe the legacy media, that all other nations are so much more progressive than we are when it comes to things like gender identity, reproductive health. What's your experience as somebody who has worked in this field and with the UN for so long? Where other nations place their stakes on issues like this?
Well, you know, on sexual orientation and gender identity, for instance, that phrase cannot even be brought into a negotiated UN document. That's how far behind the sexual revolutionaries are with regard to that. They have been pushing it for years, but they can't even. Let me back up just for one second. Sexual orientation appears in one document calling for a study on violence against gays. That's it. That's all. And they've been trying for 25 years to get this kind of language in UN documents. They've been trying for 25 years to redefine the family, to say that various forms of the family exist. They've lost on that. So on sexual orientation, gender identity, they've repeatedly lost in negotiated documents. Now, when it comes to the statements of the Secretary General and of, you know, the heads of various agencies, those guys are always saying sexual orientation and gender identity is a new category of non-discrimination. But that's false. That's not how human rights are made through the pronouncements of UN bureaucrats. You know, human rights are developed through the interaction between and among member states, and this has just not happened on sexual orientation and gender identity. With regard to abortion, of course, that's one of the most controversial issues in the entire world.
Yes.
And abortion itself would lose an up or down vote in the United Nations, which is why they have to use stealth terms like reproductive health. But like I said, President Trump has made that term controversial again. So it's astounding what the president is doing, and not a lot of people know, and I'm so glad to be able to tell your listeners what's going on.
Well, I was really impressed by Archbishop Vigano's powerful letter to President Trump. He talked about the eternal struggle between good and evil, and it really is a perfect summation of his record on international religious liberty and pro-life measures, not just in America, but around the world, somebody who values the sanctity of human life. Were you impressed, as impressed by the letter as I was?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the Catholic Church, the Vatican, the Holy See at the United Nations has always been really strong on these types of issues. I mean, this Pope, Pope Francis, who many people consider to be a liberal, has spoken out vociferously against the idea of gender ideology.
Yes.
He's spoken about it at the UN itself. So on these particular issues, the Church, the Catholic Church, has been very, very strong for many, many years at the United Nations. Vigano, what I say to people about Vigano is I wish I had known he was like this when he was nuncio. I would have spent more time with him, but I had no idea. Of course, he was the one who invited the Pope to meet with Kim Davis. From Kentucky. Kim Davis. Am I getting that right? It's been a long time.
Yes.
At the nunciature when the Pope visited Washington. So he's a very strong guy.
I want to give you a quick shout out on your book before we go, because I hear the music playing. If people want to pre-order The Catholic Case for Trump, where can they go?
They can go to Amazon. It's up for pre-order right now, and it will explain why faithful Catholics and other Christians have an obligation to vote for Trump, and that he's not violating any of the teachings of the Church, and is advancing in ways that the Democrats haven't even thought of.
Coming up, is there a cultural revolution in America? Has it already begun? We'll talk to senior writer at the National Review, David Harsanyi, right after this.
As coronavirus restrictions begin to ease, many Americans are grappling with how to adapt to the changing times. The last few months have transformed how worshipers think about church and how they are fed spiritually. While many churches are conducting services through live streams, drive-in services, and other means, questions still remain. What practical steps can we take? Are current restrictions appropriate? Do these restrictions violate the Constitution or religious freedom protections? Family Research Council has a new publication discussing religious liberty issues and offering practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate as our country opens back up. Visit frc.org/churchguidelines to view this resource and learn more. As always, visit frc.org/church for our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry on this Friday afternoon, June 12th. Thanks for joining us today. A reminder to download the Stand Firm app, available in your store, Google or Apple. And if you'd like to follow us on social media, it's at FRCDC for Twitter, at Sarah P. Perry, or at T. Perkins. Well, my next guest believes, as I do, that we have entered the era of a bloodless cultural revolution. A summation of the American cultural mob's operating principles might be summarized thusly. Western civilization is reviled, open debates denounced, city blocks mob run, words are violence, statues are racism, for starters. Joining me now to talk about this is senior writer at the National Review, David Harsanyi. David, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
This has been a great article. This is an article that appeared recently at the National Review, calling essentially exactly what this is in a summation, in a distillation of precisely what we've come to. I don't think it's an overstatement to call this a revolution. And you began with the idea of the op-ed that ran by Senator Tom Cotton at the New York Times, which apparently caused every post-millennial's head to explode. Now, I am of the mind, and as a sort of mid to late Gen Xer, that ideas are not bad and that words are not violent. But that's ultimately what we're up against. How do we battle the notion that ideas and words in and of themselves are evil?
Wow, well, that's a tough question. I think, obviously we make arguments ourselves and we continue to do so. But also, I think we have a larger embedded problem in the sense that, you know, I think a lot of these folks who believe that words are violence or don't believe in neutral principles anymore regarding free speech mm-hmm. or religious freedom or other ideals have taken over institutions like journalism and like the colleges or most of them, and entertainment. So they're the gatekeepers for this information. They're the gatekeepers for these debates, and it's very difficult to get around them. So I think the answer to your question is a complicated one, but I think that I still believe, at least, that classically liberal arguments will prevail. People who are open-minded, they just need to hear them. So I guess we just continue at it.
I think you're right in that part of the problem here, and you've written on higher education, which I also very much appreciate, but higher education is sort of the crucible for the formation of a lot of these ideas that are antithetical, ironically, to open-minded thinking. I think of Berkeley, the birthplace of the free speech movement, and you're looking now at a mob scene if you have a conservative speaker come and deign to appear on your campus. So here we are, and you've actually described them as, you know, sort of these brittle college grads, and they really are. There's a level of fragility here that somebody born in the early 70s, like me, would find laughable. You know, we were kicked out the front door and told to come back at midnight, and these are kids who find themselves needing safe spaces if the ideas of another student are an impingement on their level of personal safety. So talk to me about this relationship a little bit with higher education, because academia is overrun by left-wing perspectives. So are we relegated to the choice of going to a private college with religious affiliations, or can we entrust our kids to go out into the world and just consistently follow the values that we have and show others how not to be so fragile? I know that's another big question, but as the mother of teenagers who are now on the cusp of making these decisions, I'm going, well, there's not really an option for like home colleging. So now what do we do?
Well, if you're like me, a parent of teenagers, you know, you definitely can't trust them. So what we need to do is... Just kidding. But what we need to do is, I think, instill them with the tools they need to do critical thinking and to show them that there are other, you know, perspectives on these things. But, I mean, I have to say it's a little bit it's a downer, right? I mean, you're essentially going to be going broke to send your kids to places where people teach them things that are against your belief system. So, and not in every case, but quite often. So I think that's a problem as well. Though I also think we shouldn't overdo it in the sense that I think there are plenty of kids who are critical thinkers and plenty of kids who don't believe all this stuff. They just don't speak up because, obviously, you know, you can be ruined, but also because they just don't. You know, we have hysterics, basically, who are not worth dealing with. So, but in the career that I've chosen and the places I work in journalism, and I've been in journalism for a while and you know, and dealing with academics or intellectuals, you're seeing more and more an effort to undermine any sort of debate and to destroy people who you disagree with. In the old, you know, I'm also a Gen Xer, and in the old days, you know, people would call me evil or stupid or racist, but they let me speak right now.
Right.
If you're evil or stupid or racist, they want to shut you down. Yeah. So I don't mind being called names if I'm allowed to speak myself. And obviously I'm lucky enough, and you and I are both lucky enough to have positions where we're somewhat protected, but imagine you're in a place where everyone is against you and or mm-hmm. some academic setting, and if you say something, you can be ruined. That gets a little bit scary, and that's happening. There were at least a dozen of these struggle sessions last week where people were fired for various crimes against, you know, political correctness. Right. That is not a healthy place to have discourse.
I'm seeing right now with the wave of vandalism against statues and memorials, increasing levels of idiocy, if I can be so blunt. The newest is a petition to remove a statue of Thomas Jefferson from the Columbia campus at University of Missouri. Now, Thomas obviously had a very problematic history, owning slaves himself, as he did, but his contributions to American culture, history, and governance, I do not think can be overstated. So how do you argue with somebody? Again, we've got Winston Churchill, who's now being defaced in London. These are the greats of Western civilization. And it sounds to me like there is an increasing demand to throw the entirety of it out and start over, right? So this is the way that this sort of revolutionary mob operates. This is socialism. And I'm going to say natch communism, because that's ultimately where socialism's goal is, right? Is communism. This is what they want to do. It's an upheaval. It's a throwing out. It's a beginning again. If we forget where our roots are, what have we allowed ourselves to learn from? And how can we continue to value the history, for example, of the West, and particularly of this country that was built by individuals who overcame such insurmountable odds. Do we plant those seeds in the heart of our kids and just trust and pray that they will take root? Or do we continue to fight back and say, first of all, A, your history's wrong, and B, this is somebody that was kind of important to your being here in the first place?
Well, I think it's important, just stepping a little bit back to your asking what we should do, I think being more blunt and honest about what is happening and what things are is important. For instance, I think you're right to say this is cultural Marxism, and part of that is to erase history or revise history, and you're seeing that happen all the time. Part of it is to diminish the importance of Western civilization, of the things and ideals of the Enlightenment and the things that we're supposed to believe in. Those are for sure things that are going on. And it doesn't mean that everyone who marches believes that stuff, but it's certainly part of the movement. So when you mention a Thomas Jefferson statue, listen, I am sympathetic to taking down statues of people who fought for the Confederacy. However, I'm not sympathetic to having a mob coming and taking them down, you know, in the way they do. And I also know that this is a slippery slope and they're going to move on. They have, like you mentioned, to Jefferson, to Churchill, people who are problematic, not the ideals for which they stood, which are not problematic to me at all, right? I mean, Thomas Jefferson was an imperfect man who had some perfect ideas that he, you know, wrote down for us. And I think making that distinction is important, as we do with any institution. A school, for instance, is not a bad place simply because there are bad teachers. We don't tear down institutions because people are imperfect. So I guess that's one of the arguments I'd make, but you have to take them, I believe you have to take them one by one, and then you have to be really blunt and honest about what's going on. What we have now is a debate, I think, between liberals and people who are illiberal, and we are the liberals. They've stolen that word, but I don't think that they actually mean it anymore.
Yes, I would agree with that. And thank you for making that distinction, because to say that you are liberal is not a bad thing, although it is now. I would say that the connotation of that word is completely different now if you use it in a political dialogue with somebody, because we've taken the notion and it has now ultimately been swept up. It is fully owned by the left, and it's kind of a regressive liberalism where we dig further and further and further and further down. This is where we're driven by identity politics, and one idea that is bad begets digging enough to find another idea that is also bad and another idea that is related to that idea. And the manifestations of this, the tentacles of an idea being bad, an idea being violence, an idea being something to be fought against and destroyed at all costs, and at this point we're dealing with physical destruction, is, to my mind, sort of it's a discrediting, I think, to this current generation. And it's sad for me, because we're always harping on millennials, and aren't they such snowflakes? And yet, by the same token, the millennials are subject to, in many ways, the way they were parented. We try to raise our kids in such a way where they can be autonomous, they can be independent, they can hold a perspective, they can engage in debates, they can value another person, but they also don't bend with the times. And I think this is what we're seeing, is we're sort of seeing this progressive pendulum swing to the left. If ideas are no longer safe just to be entertained, if they are themselves dangerous, and the left is incapable of living by neutral principles, as you said, where does that naturally go? What's the natural arc of history? Because what I'm seeing on the horizon is something very big that needs to take place if we are to, in any respect, reclaim the opportunities to teach our kids well and to value the country and the civilization that we've built, even though it has flaws.
Well, I think, you know, when I think of a pendulum swinging to the left, I think at some point liberalism and conservatism become the same, because we're trying to hold on to things that are liberal, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest tragedy of our kids' generation, and again, plenty of good kids and plenty of young people who are smart and don't believe this stuff, but generally, I think, is that they've convinced them, or we've convinced them, or they've convinced themselves that this is the hardest, worst time ever on Earth, when the opposite is true. This is the greatest time ever. They are safer than ever. They are richer than ever. They have more choices than ever before. The world is a better place than ever before. And that doesn't, and yet they speak about the world as if everything is terrible, and then they act like everything is terrible, and then we have what's going on now. It's not to say the world's perfect. Obviously, this coronavirus crisis is a horrible thing. I can't think of anything similar, right? But the reaction, you know, I think people lose perspective. So that's part of it. I mean, I think that's part of it. But also, and just generally, because things are so good, people get a little bored, or I don't know if boredom is the right word, but they start to find problems, small problems, and make them into big problems, you know, and that might be part of it as well. But certainly, I think there was a long march through all the institutions, as I mentioned before, and I think now they can, you know, leftist control in many ways, educational system from kindergarten on into higher education, the entertainment industry, and, you know, many academic and intellectual circles and journalism. So it's very difficult to fight that, very difficult. So I think social media and things like that have opened it up and allowed others to make arguments in some ways, but it's also in other ways kind of a cesspool, moral cesspool, so that's no fun either. So it's a difficult situation.
you get the good and the bad, unfortunately. Yeah. So this is another big question. Here's what I want to leave with, and I asked Ken Blackwell in my first block how he would future cast the November election, because these are unprecedented times. Do you think that the era in which we live, that has a great deal, that is prosperous, but seems to those who are younger to be horrid, what kind of an outcome do you think that portends in the election?
I would say it's very difficult for me to say at this point, simply because I don't know what the economy looks like a month from now or 2 months from now, because it's such an unusual, unique situation. And even though, even if conservatives lose, listen, if Republicans lose the Senate and House and presidency, I think that's very bad news for America, because I think there'll be all kinds of terrible policy initiatives. If they hold one of those and can stop it, I think you'll have the deadlock we've had for a long time. If you have Biden be president, I think there'll be a backlash to that. If there's one thing history shows us, and I don't think history has like a trajectory, I think it's all over the place, but there's one thing it has shown us, is that there's always a backlash, always a blowback to anything that happens. Mm-hmm. And you can't riot in cities, you can't have lawlessness without there being a push. You're a Gen Xer like me. I grew up in New York City in the 70s. It was a crime-ridden place until the 90s. It was a horrible place to live for many people. And then there was a big pushback against it. So, you know, whatever is going to happen, I think there's going to be some counterbalance to what's gone on.
My guest has been David Harsanyi, who is a senior writer for National Review and the author of First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun. It's available on Amazon. Find his work at nationalreview.com. This has been Washington Watch. I've been your host, Sarah Perry. Look forward to being with you all next week. And until then, we'll see you later.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.